All right, so I'm Matt Robbins. I'm not in your department, but a guest. So I am, I probably will meet all of you when you rotate at Weiler. I'm typically the consult attending at Weiler all the time now. So that's probably where I will encounter most of you. I also work at the Headache Center and see patients there. So this talk is going to be very case-based because I think it's more interesting that way. So there are 10 kind of rapid-fire cases of neurologic emergencies, and I think it would be more interesting that way. This is going to be important to all of you because you all rotate in the ER, you all have these emergencies on your services. In many hospitals, like Jacoby, you're the primary caretaker of neurologic patients, and it's certainly on your boards. So all these above reasons are relevant to you. So let's get started. So the first case, so this is a 49-year-old guy who's found lying outside of Bronx Psych, and the staff members find him to be unresponsive, and they, in retrospect, thought that the day before he wasn't talking as much as usual. So not an atypical presentation to the Jacoby ER. So he takes Haldol Q monthly, the depot injection, and he's also on Seroquel at night. And his exam, which will mostly be a neurologic exam, he's a little bit hypertensive, he's a little bit tachycardic, and he's got a low-grade fever. He looks perfectly awake, but he's not interactive in any meaningful way. He is very rigid, so, you know, axial and appendicular. Axial means more truncal rigidity or proximal rigidity, including the neck. Appendicular rigidity is more the limbs, so he's rigid in both places, but he's not tremulous, he's not having any other abnormal movements. So what could this be? Audience participation is encouraged. So neuroleptic malignant syndrome, certainly. What else, though? Meningitis. So could this be meningitis? Sure. What else? That was mentioned, yes. What else? So could this be a seizure? Maybe he's in non-convulsive status epilepticus? Sure. What else? I mean, those are some good ones. NMS, certainly. You know, could this just be a guy who has some baseline psychiatric problem and he has some intercurrent infection that's rendering him more encephalopathic than usual? I'm sure that's probably more common than any of the other causes, although perhaps less dangerous. You know, is he withdrawing from something? We didn't get that history. NMS, we discussed. Serotonin syndrome, a lot of these dopamine, a lot of these neuroleptic medications have more broad-spectrum neurotransmitter antagonism, so serotonin syndrome isn't impossible. Could he just be severely catatonic from horrible schizophrenia? I guess it's possible, too, although he's a bit febrile and has some autonomic disturbance. Perhaps this is an acute dystonic reaction from just one dose too many of his neuroleptics. Malignant hyperthermia, I suppose it's possible, and just Parkinsonism that's maybe aggravated by some intercurrent illness. So what test would you like? You are in the ER. You have one test to do. Good. So it's high. So, good. So this is a case of NMS. I'm sure this person would get a CAT scan, would have a neurology consult, perhaps an LP anyway, but he has many of the features. So what's the triad for NMS? This is certainly board and in-service testable. Actually, it's not part of the triad. So fever, what else? Rigidity and altered mental status, right? So remember that fever does not actually have to be a high fever. It can be, in this guy, he had 100.3. It could be 99 or higher. The rigidity is very classic, so neurologists like to recognize this as lead pipe rigidity. So this is the type of patient who you take their neck, you try to lift their head up off the bed, and their whole body comes with it. It's different from nuchal rigidity from meningitis, which is more just with neck flexion. This is rigidity in all directions of head movement. So other features, an elevated CK. Certainly an elevated white count can be seen commonly. Autonomic instability, this patient has mild manifestations of that. And it usually is a pretty rapid, although it can be subacute presentation.
I think it's just
recognized very early. So what other situation can you get NMS from? So obviously this patient's on multiple dopamine blockers, but what's another situation? Excellent, excellent. So withdrawal of Sinemet in the patient with Parkinson's. So a sudden withdrawal of dopamine agonists or dopamine replacement therapy can. So you may see in the ICU, you have a patient with Parkinson's, comes in with sepsis, has respiratory failure, gets intubated, maybe an NG tube isn't placed right away, maybe it takes a day for someone to think that he may need some parenteral nutrition or longer, his Sinemet isn't given to him, and suddenly he's febrile. When you wean from sedation, he's not responding, and you find him to be more rigid, his CK is high, it's not a cardiac origin. This could happen. It's probably under-recognized. And the other thing is there's mild degrees of this. It's not an absolute thing. So you can have just one or two of the features of the triad, maybe some other supportive features in the second category. So it's not an all-or-nothing phenomenon. The risk factors, this patient has many of them, including he's on a high-potency neuroleptic like Haldol. The monthly injections of these medications that can be done with things like Haldol or Prolixin, those are particularly strong risk factors. And if the dose is increased quickly, if someone's dehydrated, this is often tipped off by an intercurrent infection. So these are the risk factors. So how do you manage it? What do you do? So dantrolene, what does dantrolene do? Right, so exactly. So it kind of uncouples the sarcoplasmic reticulum intracellularly in muscle. So it may treat the rigidity, but it might not treat the underlying syndrome. So how do you treat the underlying syndrome? So supportive care, certainly. You have to hydrate. You often have, you of course have to stop if they're taking an agent. But dopamine agonists are the way you treat it. So just think mechanistically, that's how you do it. And often, of course, you have to prevent acute renal failure. I know alkalinization of the urine is a controversial medical topic that you are probably more experienced than I am in for hyper-CKemia. You always look for underlying infection because it's often triggered by that. Bromocriptine is the dopamine agonist of choice. Dantrolene is often if bromocriptine alone isn't working. And improvement isn't rapid, so it might take 2 weeks. So just don't think someone's going to become their normal self rapidly. Sorry? That can be used sometimes to treat the rigidity or sometimes the autonomic lability, but not that's not usually a first-line treatment. And, some of these patients have severe schizophrenia. They might be suicidal. You need to put them on a medication to suppress that, but don't do it until 2 weeks at the earliest. So next case, this is kind of a parallel case. This is a 41-year-old woman. She's from Europe. She has a history of depression. She's brought to the ER because her family says she looks like she's acting drunk, but she's not drinking. She was on a medication in France that was stopped just a week ago. And they found that in place of that, she's taking venlafaxine. So what is venlafaxine? So it's an SNRI. It's a combined serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. Effexor is the common name. So her exam, taken right from the New England Journal of Medicine. She has all of these features. She has autonomic lability. She's tachycardic. She has tremor. She's very hyperreflexic. Her pupils are dilated. It doesn't say it there. It says she has clonus, which is something that's just elicited in the ankles. But she has myoclonus, so frequent shock-like movements of her extremities. So what is this? I agree. So serotonin syndrome. So just it's much rarer than NMS. What do you think the medication could have been that she was on in Europe? So an MAO inhibitor, right. So they're still used occasionally in the United States. They're actually used sometimes for refractory headache prevention. But in Europe, they're used more often for depression than in this country. So perhaps there wasn't a long enough washout period for the MAO inhibitor before she started on a new drug. So, the important thing for serotonin syndrome is distinguishing it from NMS because there's some overlap. So they both have similar agents that can do it, although something that can really tip off serotonin syndrome, which is underrecognized, is Demerol. So we all hate Demerol, but it often needs to be used for pain control on surgical surfaces. I guess sometimes for patients with gallbladder dysfunction, it might be needed because it doesn't constrict the sphincter of Oddi. That's probably controversial also. But that's a common cause of this. So the rigidity is much more prominent in neuroleptic malignant syndrome, and the movement disorder in serotonin syndrome is myoclonus, so the sudden shock-like movements of the face, arms, legs. And the pupils are dilated in serotonin syndrome, and they're not in neuroleptic malignant syndrome. So those are the main distinguishing clinical features of the two. And there's a million drugs that cause serotonin syndrome. We won't go through it, but Reglan is another one. Reglan can also cause neuroleptic malignant syndrome. It is a dopamine blocker. We all use it. We should be aware of it. So this is more, this is managed more with benzos than NMS, because patients tend to be more agitated than more rigid. So often you remove the offending agent and it's really just supportive care. These using serotonin blocking agents is very anecdotal, and it's only if you can't treat the patient properly with just supportive care. So
you have benzo withdrawal, and it's been a week long.
Oh, in the differential for that patient? Perhaps. But she didn't have such autonomic lability. I didn't give much of an exam there, but she didn't. Just trust me. So let's do the next case. So this is a 40-year-old woman who comes to the ER with new onset constant left frontal pain for 2 days. And this is what her exam shows. So what does she have? What does she have on exam? So perhaps, maybe the left eye is a little bit deviated inward, but not. What else? Yes, there is ptosis on the left, right? Sorry? You might interpret it as swelling, but it's probably not. But I agree, there's certainly ptosis. I mean, the distance between this upper pupillary margin to the eyelid is much bigger than this distance. So there's ptosis. So how do you get ptosis? There's two main mechanisms. Right. So a Horner syndrome is one. And what's the other way? And a third nerve palsy. So what is in a Horner syndrome, is the pupil bigger or smaller?
Smaller.
And how about this lady? Smaller. The left one is smaller. And the other thing in Horner syndrome, Horner's affects the Mueller's muscle, so it's a small sympathetic innervated muscle in the upper eyelid, but there's actually a Mueller's muscle of the lower eyelid as well. So if you can notice, there's actually lower lid ptosis as well, or reverse ptosis, which is often never picked up. So this distance between the lid and the pupil is much smaller than this distance, which you can clearly see when you zoom in. So this is a Horner. So new onset left frontal headache and a Horner syndrome. Right, so here is your MRI of the neck, and the big white arrow tells you what's the problem, and you see a kind of a crescent-shaped hyperintensity in the left internal carotid. So this is carotid dissection. So, one misconception about carotid dissection: headache is much more common than neck pain. So that's often not known. And it can be thunderclap in onset. So thunderclap headache means what? It often signifies that, but what does just the word the phrase mean? Right, so it's headache that peaks to maximal intensity within a minute of onset. So headache is, so it can't, this isn't a differential thunderclap headache. So headache is more common than neck pain in carotid dissection. Vertebral artery dissection, it's not the case. And the headache is often in the first division of the trigeminal nerve distribution, or the V1 distribution, like this lady. Left frontal headache. So Horner's syndrome can occur in just under half. You don't have the lack of sweating, because where the dissection occurs is after the fibers are already, the sympathetic fibers for the skin already branch off with the external carotid and follow the external carotid towards the skin. Because dissections are almost always internal carotid. You usually don't have common carotid dissection. So pulsatile tinnitus, you know, patients complain of whooshing sounds in their ears that often correspond with their pulse. So cranial nerve palsies can happen. You know, everyone always looks for tongue deviation and no one ever sees it or thinks they have it. This is one case where it can happen. And, of course, the dreaded complication of carotid dissection is subsequent stroke, either retinal or cerebral. So it's quite common. So risk factors for dissection, what are they? So trauma. So what are some of the kind of anecdotal things people talk about? So chiropractic manipulation, being in a barber shop that used to be called beauty parlor stroke, yoga, perhaps, but connective tissue disorders. So people who have, who've never been diagnosed, you know, the ones that you're more familiar with are on the bottom. So family history, there's actually some familial component to it. So often these patients report an antecedent infection. This we talked about. So conventional vascular risk factors put you at risk of injury to the intima of the carotid, and also migraine is a risk factor, perhaps from some endothelial dysfunction that's associated with migraine. So how do you treat this? Or how do you test for it? And I already showed you a test. So CT angio of the neck or an MRA of the neck. It's not known which one is superior. Probably MRA is better. You know, a conventional angio is the best, but you often don't get that right away. And most patients improve. So you treat with anticoagulants to prevent subsequent stroke, but there's a recent study that showed that perhaps 325 of aspirin showed a similar low recurrent risk of stroke in these patients, so this might change in the next few years. And the duration of treatment, so you might see these patients in your clinic after you saw them in the hospital, you actually base your treatment on how their neck artery recanalizes based on imaging studies. So if there's still evidence of intimal injury, you may keep them on anticoagulation for a bit longer. All right, next case. So this is a 63-year-old guy. He's right-handed, and he woke up in the morning. He's hallucinating. So he's seeing his mother, but she's been dead for a long time. And he seems to be getting more confused, and when he looks up, he's seeing double. And he's also a bit unsteady. And he's got a history of smoking, hypertension, diabetes, AFib. His exam, he's quite hypertensive. He's drowsy, but he's oriented. He has no language disturbance. He's got a left homonymous hemianopsia. He's got right ptosis, hypotropia, meaning when the patient looks straight ahead, the right eye is a bit down, and exotropia, meaning it's out. So the right eye, when the patient's looking straight ahead, is down and out. He's unable to look up at all with both eyes. He has bilateral Babinski signs, but no real weakness, and he's very ataxic. So this is a confusing case. It's got a lot of neurologic findings. So basically, it's a guy who has encephalopathy, evidence of perhaps right occipital dysfunction. You know, a right ptosis, inability to look up, is probably a third nerve lesion. Bilateral Babinski signs has to affect both corticospinal tracts in an area where they travel relatively close together, and ataxia has to affect cerebellar pathways. So the key with this patient is the third nerve involvement. So what part of the brain is the third cranial nerve in? Midbrain, right. And so this is the least affecting his midbrain, and the hallucinations are probably what are puzzling you a lot. So I'll just tell you, this patient gets a CAT scan, and, you know, it looks pretty good, but if you take a really close look, the basilar artery is hyperdense, so that little white structure in between the cerebral peduncles and the upper pons, you can see that there might be a clot there. It could be a neck calcified vessel, but in this case, that was the only slice where it looked hyperdense. So this is actually what's called top of the basilar syndrome. It's a life-threatening stroke syndrome, and it's very under-recognized, because people are often labeled as having some behavioral disturbance, they're hallucinating, so I'll explain why. So there's three groups of manifestations of this syndrome. So one is ocular motor, right? This patient certainly had that. The second is behavioral. So you can hallucinate from midbrain lesions. No one really knows why, but the theory is, you know, the reticular activating system, the part of the brain that's diffusely in the brainstem that projects widely to the hemispheres, can be affected and somehow cause some cognitive dysregulation and produce hallucinations. And by the same mechanism, or by a different mechanism, you can have amnesia because the basilar artery splits into the posterior cerebral arteries, which feeds both hippocampi, you know, the parts of the brain that subserve producing episodic memory. And of course, visual symptoms by the posterior cerebral arteries, which branch off the basilar artery, subserve the occipital lobes, and you can get either, you can be cortically blind, you can have a homonymous hemianopsia. So this patient had this syndrome, and it's life-threatening. You know, these are the patients who develop the locked-in syndrome. So sometimes you can see ataxia, and once patients present with this, often it's very poor, so we try to do heroic things. Like, you know, they don't do it here that often, or, you know, IV tPA, of course, is done here, but intra-arterial tPA, if the patient's outside of the thrombolytic window, can be done within 6 hours, or doing a catheterization and trying to actually physically remove the clot by a retrieval device. So even in acute stroke, even patients who have new onset AFib, we rarely anticoagulate them because the risk of bleeding is high from the onset. This is a patient where we probably would, because the risk of death, whether you treat them or not, is quite high. So that's that case. Just remember, oculomotor disturbance, behavioral disturbance, and even hallucinations are very under-recognized. But if this happens acutely, it sounds like this could be herpes encephalitis or something else, but it's actually a stroke syndrome. So the next case, this is a 56-year-old guy who started having back pain. And it started 2 weeks ago. He was in his garage and he was lifting a heavy box, and it started pretty acutely. He took some Motrin, you know, on a near daily basis, and it got somewhat better, but then since the day before he comes in, the pain got a lot worse. He's very sweaty, and both of his legs have started to become numb. He's a known diabetic and asthmatic. In his exam, vital signs, maybe his temperature, you know, pulse is 91, nothing, temperature 99.4, nothing to write home about. His back isn't tender. Above the neck, there's nothing wrong with him. So paraparesis, of course, means bilateral leg weakness, which he has mild. His reflexes are 2+, although he's missing a left triceps jerk, and he's got bilateral Babinski signs. He doesn't have any proprioception, or he has absent vibration in his legs and diminished pinprick. He's got a Romberg sign, and his gait is spastic, which goes with his bilateral paraparesis. So what part of the nervous system does this seem to localize to? So certainly spinal cord, right? He's got bilateral upper motor neuron signs. He's got no cranial nerve abnormalities. He's got no mental status changes. There's nothing cerebral or brainstem that can really do this necessarily, acutely. So let's just say it's a spinal cord lesion. Where in the spinal cord? Is it cervical, thoracic, lumbar? I didn't give you a good clue. I didn't say there's a sensory level. So which part? Why cervical? Right. So at the level of a spinal cord lesion, you can have lower motor neuron signs. So an absent triceps jerk, which is C7, C8, could indicate that. But certainly he's having upper motor neuron signs bilaterally. Just remember that patients who have long-standing diabetes, they often have a superimposed neuropathy, so perhaps if he didn't have a neuropathy, his reflexes would have been more brisk than you're appreciating on this exam. And Romberg sign means his proprioception, or possibly the dorsal columns of the spinal cord are affected. So what's in the differential for this guy? So subacute combined degeneration, which is from what? So I see what you're saying. He's got corticospinal tract and proprioceptive difficulty. But he has prominent what? What goes against that? That could be. Well, this started really acutely, right? Two weeks ago he was normal. And he has severe pain. So pain is usually from an extrinsic compressive lesion of the cord rather than an intrinsic cord lesion, at least acutely. So what else could it be? That's what he just mentioned. That's from what? So disc herniation. So perhaps he has a C7, C8 herniated disc, a C7, T1 herniated disc, or he has a C6, C7 herniated disc that's central. Sure, I think that's certainly possible. But what else?
Infarction?
What kind of infection? Infarction. So usually proprioception is preserved in infarction. An infarction affects the anterior spinal artery. It usually affects the watershed area of the cord, which is kind of an upper thoracic level. And often it's from procedures or global hypoperfusion in a patient who has cardiac arrest. So I don't know about that. He has prominent pain, so it may not be that. What else?
Abscess.
What kind of an abscess?
Staph.
So staph, where is the abscess? So an epidural abscess, good. Sorry?
Wouldn't you have focal tenderness though?
Well, it depends. You know, focal, you know, it's hard to say. You know, tenderness, when you percuss the spine, it implies that there's at least bony involvement or soft tissue involvement of the subcutaneous space. So that's not a sensitive sign. So what we were talking about, I think this is important just to recognize in terms of cord lesions that are compressive versus within the substance of the cord itself. So pain is typically a compressive lesion. Just think about a patient who has a herniated disc that come in with severe pain. Patients who have prostate cancer with vertebral mets and compress the spinal cord that way. Same thing. And bowel and bladder symptoms, we didn't discuss that. That's often a feature of intramedullary cord syndrome. So patients with multiple sclerosis who have a big demyelinating plaque in their spinal cord, they may have bowel or bladder symptoms really early. And it's usually very latent, ominous features from a compressive lesion. So I'll skip the rest of that, but those are the main points. So he had a white count of 17,000 and a SED rate, which was reasonably high for a youngish guy. So I agree that when you image his spine, you should do it with contrast, look for infection. And what you can see is there's this huge loculated mass that starts at around the T7 area, which explains why his triceps jerk is out and why he's upper motor neuron signed. So he's got a terrible epidural abscess. So what are the risk factors for this? This is very important for you guys.
Diabetes
is probably the biggest one. What else?
IV
drug use, excellent. Trauma to the back, patients who have had procedures in the back, drug abusers, of course, immunosuppression, which alcoholism counts. You know, diabetics are thought to live in this chronic, mildly immunosuppressed state, and that's the explanation given for this. This can happen in pregnancy by a similar mechanism. So we talked about all these. So Staph aureus, like you guys mentioned, is almost always the cause, and MRSA, of course, is so common that you often start with vanco empirically. Other strep species are less common. You can have gram negatives and anaerobes. And it's often accompanied by not just an epidural abscess, but you can have adjacent vertebral osteomyelitis and discitis. It's very common. So what do you do? You know, of course, you image with contrast. MRI is much better than CAT scan. This is a reason to get the MRI technician out of bed in the middle of the night. Blood cultures are often positive. You don't do a spinal tap because you are at risk of puncturing the abscess or transmitting bacteria into the intrathecal space, which could be dangerous. So, of course, you call neurosurgery. If you like to call orthospine because they're your friends, feel free. If it's small, often interventional radiology can drain it. And antibiotics, you know, vanco, because MRSA is so common, you treat that with first. And if you're suspicious for other organisms based on immunosuppression, et cetera, you give them. So, of course, tumors cause cord compression. The most common ones are breast, lung, prostate, lymphoma, sarcoma, and renal cell. Management is somewhat similar in that you need urgent MRI with contrast. And depending upon the patient, that's how you tailor your treatment. You know, often it's a patient with diffuse whose prognosis is perhaps poor, or if their spine is unstable, they may not do well with surgery. They might need radiation. Steroids are almost always indicated. The dose is very variable. So traumatic cord compression from herniated disc, even, you know, it's very controversial about giving steroids, but I think we all would do it anyway. And the initial bolus can be a giant dose of steroid. So that's it for cord compression. You know, when patients have low back pain, and that's severe in onset with neurologic symptoms, it's not cord compression. It's either conus medullaris or caught Aquinas syndrome. Because think, the spinal cord ends at what level? Sorry? So L1, right? Because you do your LPs, you're doing it L3, L4, L2, L3, L4, L5. So of course the spinal cord ends earlier. So that's where it ends. In this example, it ends at around L1, L2. So the patients who end up getting conus medullaris syndrome, where the tip of the spinal cord itself is affected, is often from compression fractures. So it could be a T12 or an L1 compression fracture, which is not that uncommon in patients. That can cause conus medullaris syndrome. Caught Aquinas from a typical L5, S1 herniated disc, or L4, L5. So they're different. Caught Aquinas, you often see more prominent autonomic symptoms, so patients may have inability to urinate, or maybe incontinent early. They might have, if they're men, they might not be able to have erections. The Claude Aquin is much more asymmetric, so you often have one leg with radicular pain or sensory loss more affected than the other. Both can have saddle anesthesia. And in these cases, you don't look for brisk reflexes in the legs, you look for absent reflexes in the legs, because this is a lower motor neuron disorder, right? The nerve roots are being affected, not the spinal cord itself. All right. You may see less weakness in the conus medullaris syndrome because you're affecting the tip of the spinal cord, which is really the lower sacral nerve roots, which subserve mainly, you know, bowel, bladder, and erectile function. All right. So that's an example of a T12 compression fracture. You can see how it can clearly give you conus medullaris syndrome. Next case. So this is a 34-year-old lady who comes into the ER with 3 days of worsening headache. And a week ago, she had a baby, and she had an epidural. And it went fine. In the ER, she seized. This is her exam. Her mental status is normal. Her optic discs show mild signs of high intracranial pressure. She's got a field cut, a left inferior quadrantinopia is usually from a right parietal lesion. She's got a mild left facial droop. Her left hand is a little weak. She has a cortical sensory sign on the left, which is referable to the right parietal region. And she's got a mild hemiparetic gait. So this is a lady who has evidence of high intracranial pressure and right frontoparietal dysfunction with a seizure. And this is someone who just gave birth and had epidural. So what are the possibilities?
Eclampsia.
So eclampsia, sure. That can be one. What else?
Pseudotumor.
So maybe this is unleashing pseudotumor, but have you heard of patients with pseudotumor seizing? Very uncommon. It's possible. I guess you'd have to have a right to left shunt. So subarachnoid hemorrhage, possible. But just, you know, you should harp on the fact that this person has focal deficits, right? Subarachnoid hemorrhage often causes encephalopathy, could cause seizures. Maybe if it's from an aneurysm, could cause a third nerve palsy. But this lady has, you know, she's telling you that the right side of her right cerebral hemisphere has something going on. So an intracranial hemorrhage is possible, but from an abscess is possible. She had a procedure, but she's postpartum. You know, if this lady came in a week after an epidural and having a baby with unilateral leg pain, with swelling, the leg was a bit warm, you would get a Doppler on her in a second to rule out a DVT. The same thing you should think for the brain. So this lady most likely could have a cortical vein thrombosis, right? By the same mechanism. You're particularly hypercoagulable postpartum or peripartum. So you get so the differential of things we discussed, you know, this I think is less likely. It shouldn't cause the focal hemispheric findings. You know, the CSF leak, sometimes it can cause subdurals associated with it, so it's possible. This is a syndrome associated with preeclampsia and other disorders, which is possible, but we won't get into it. And PRESS, which is kind of on the spectrum of preeclampsia and eclampsia, is possible. Often causes more prominent visual disturbance because it affects the occipital regions usually. So this lady is a CAT scan, and you know, when you see bright on the brain, it looks like hemorrhage. So there is hemorrhage there. Could this be a MCA stroke? It just looks weird, right? There's like kind of linear areas of hemorrhage. This actually crosses over into two different arterial vascular territories. So this is kind of PCA and this is MCA. So that's not usually an arterial phenomenon. It doesn't cross arterial territories. So knowing that she's hypercoagulable, you get an MRI of her brain and an MRV, and you see that her superior sagittal sinus is not filling. So she has superior sagittal sinus thrombosis. So just think, mild increased intracranial pressure, and that was probably the biggest clue. So on CAT scan, it has to be with contrast. The hallmark is this empty delta sign where you see a lack of filling of the superior sagittal sinus by that black arrow. So it's usually the transverse sinuses are affected the most, but they're usually in combination. So often it's the superior sagittal sinus. Sometimes it's not a sinus at all. It's just one of these cortical veins that are branches can thrombose and cause maybe just a seizure without any focal findings. So keep this in the back of your mind. Brains can have DVTs too. So of course there's a million different risk factors. You guys are all familiar with this stuff. You know, nephrotic syndrome is probably an under-recognized one. Various infections, etc. So of course headache is extremely common, as are seizures, hemorrhagic stroke from a venous stroke, focal findings. If it extends to the cavernous sinus, you can affect cranial nerves. So with this lady, you would actually put her on heparin anyway. So even though she has intracranial hemorrhage, it will only worsen if you don't treat it. Because if you don't relieve the obstruction, she's going to have more venous edema and oozing and intracranial hemorrhage. So paradoxically, you actually treat these patients with heparin. I'm sure you've probably seen, you know, Lenora Kov or Peter maybe do it and think that they're crazy. But it's actually what you do. And just like with carotid dissections, when you treat these patients chronically, you actually serially do re-imaging to see if the vein or the sinus recanalized. All right, let's try to get through the rest. So case 7. So this is a 30-year-old guy who comes into the ER. He's got no medical problems that he knows of, and he's dyspneic. So this sounds like a good medical case. So 6 days ago, he had a sore throat, and it's been continuing. 3 days ago, he's noticed that his legs and arms are somewhat weak. And then 2 days ago, his voice has become somewhat softer, and he's had difficulty chewing. And then when he gets to the ER, he's dyspneic on exertion, which never happened before. And then even at rest, he's a bit short of breath. So this sounds like something that could be, it could be medical, it could be some ENT problem, it could be neurological, I suppose. So let's look at the exam. So let's think about it. So his vitals may be mildly tachypneic and tachycardic. Mental status is normal. He's got ptosis bilaterally. His extraocular movements show he's telling you he has diplopia on horizontal gaze bilaterally. His speech is breathy and soft. He's actually weak in his neck flexors and extensors and his proximal arms. And his sensation is normal. Reflexes are 1+. He didn't have Babinski signs. So what do you think now? So I hear two things. So myasthenia I like because the patient has cranial muscle abnormalities, right? Extraocular movement weakness, ptosis, so it sounds pretty good. Respiratory dysfunction. Guillain-Barré is possible, but the guy has his reflexes that are relatively preserved. And the cranial nerve findings are not that typical for Guillain-Barré, but it's still not impossible. Anything else? I mean, this exam shows you that it's probably not an abscess in his throat causing these progressive symptoms. And what you have to know is that when patients have weakness of their neck flexors and extensors, that is almost always neurological. That's very rare. It's almost always from myasthenia or even ALS. So you do a blood gas because you're good ER docs or good medicine residents rotating in the ER. And there is a mild, he's acidotic. His PaO2 is probably low for what he should be. He's already retaining CO2, and he's probably got a compensatory metabolic alkalosis, but it's probably not compensating enough. So his x-ray is normal, and his FVC is 12 cc's per kilogram. So what's a worrisome FVC? So 10 would be horrible. 15 would be very worrisome. So 15 in patients who have known neuromuscular disorders are often grounds for intubation. So that's very abnormal. So clinical features of neuromuscular respiratory failure are very similar to clinical features of any respiratory failure. So this slide is not that helpful. But the cheap FVC that neurologists use is an inability to count past 20 in a single breath. So you have them take a deep breath in and they 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You could do it to 20 easily, but if they can't, that's often a cheap FVC that you can assess. So these signs are not that specific to neuromuscular disorders, but that might be. So this guy has myasthenia. It's certainly based on the prominent cranial musculature abnormalities and the double vision. So things that can trigger this, there's a million things. Pregnancy, infections, you know, there's an emotional stress in there. Concomitant pulmonary problems are often what triggers it. So patients often come in with a mixed picture. They have pneumonia and newly diagnosed myasthenia, which makes things confusing, which is when us as neurologists rely on you guys for help. So things that worsen existing myasthenia or could trigger it, these are some of the medications. So antibiotics are big ones. Quinolones and immunoglycosides are the worst. Patients may have myasthenia en masse when they're intubated for unrelated reasons, and have paralytic agents used. In terms of blood pressure medications, almost all of them do it. So often we think that ACE inhibitors are the antihypertensive agent of choice in myasthenics because they are not known to trigger it. And steroids also, I'll explain that in a more. So for myasthenic crisis, sometimes you try to get away with using non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. If they're already hypercapnic, it's probably not going to work in neuromuscular disorders. And these are the kind of the grounds for intubating. Hypoxemia and neuromuscular respiratory failure is a very late and ominous feature, and of course they can't support their airway from neuromuscular bulbar dysfunction. So the way you treat it is IVIG or plasmapheresis. They probably work the same. Acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, you often stop when they get intubated because they're promoting increased acetylcholine. They can cause increased secretions. Steroids you don't use acutely, they don't work. They actually often make patients worse. So when we have even a known myasthenic that we see in our clinic and we want to start them on steroids as maintenance therapy, we often admit them to the hospital to start 20 of prednisone or 10 of prednisone and titrate it up. So you may get a patient like this occasionally from a neurology clinic that we follow with you, think that we're totally absurd for admitting someone to start them on 10 of prednisone, but I tell you we're not. Because we've all of the neurology residents, I'm sure, have seen patients who get started on 10 of prednisone for myasthenia and end up in the ER intubated. It happens. So don't think we're crazy. So we have three more cases to try to get through them. 40-year-old lady comes to the ER with 5 days of weakness of her legs. She's got a little bit of tingling of her toes and fingertips. Then yesterday, her arms feel a little bit weak. And 2 weeks prior to that, she had the flu. So I'm sure everyone thinks this is what the other case was not. Her exam, she has a transverse smile, which means, you know, when you smile, it's like this. The smile doesn't go up like the Joker. It's just kind of horizontal, which means it's probably mild bifacial weakness. This person is weak distally more than proximally, but certainly both, and has some mild sensory signs. Certainly hyporeflexic, no reflexes in the legs. So Guillain-Barré, or AIDP, is what this patient has. So the tests you do. This is really a clinical diagnosis, and the tests, if you do the tests too soon, they may be negative, and they may still have Guillain-Barré. So when you do an LP, what's the phrase that they use for the findings? Right, so cytoalbuminemic dissociation. So you can see white cells. Most patients don't, but if they're usually less than 50. If they're higher than 50, you have to think this is Guillain-Barré caused by one of these disorders. The protein is almost always high. But if you do the tap right away, just like if you do the EMG right away, you might not pick up any abnormalities, so you often have to wait. So, but by the end of week two, they're almost always, protein's almost always elevated. And same with EMG. So this is a demyelinating peripheral neuropathy. These are features that you don't have to know. They're often normal early, so it's never, you shouldn't wake up Dr. Gelito to do an EMG at 3 in the morning. There are all sorts of variants. So, especially particularly in patients from China, the one that's most closely associated with Campylobacter, which is the famous bacterial infection that predisposes you to having this, is an axonal variant of Guillain-Barré, not the demyelinating one. And the one that neurologists love is this Miller-Fisher one, which is this bizarro demyelinating polyneuropathy that has central nervous system features. So that's the triad. The abnormal eye movements and ataxia is unusual for central nervous system lesions really clues you into this diagnosis. So there's a million other variants. You can have what's called Bickerstaff brainstem encephalitis. There was a patient here we thought may have had that a couple of years ago. It's on the spectrum of Guillain-Barré. These are really rare, these other variants, but acute autonomic disturbance is part of that. Anyway, the way you manage this is, supportive care is often important, and of course, IVIG and plasmapheresis. Steroids don't work for Guillain-Barré, they just don't. There's CIDP, which is a chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, which is often associated with diabetes, but not always. That actually responds to prednisone, but Guillain-Barré is a different disease. It's not the same thing, and it doesn't. These patients often can get an ileus, which is underrecognized, so you guys should be good doctors and put them on a bowel regimen if they have it. And of course, getting frequent FVCs if they're not already intubated is very important. So Second to last case, this is a 71-year-old lady who comes into the ER for 2 days of headache and confusion. And when she was asked, she said she had a diffuse headache, but she wasn't really coherent. So this already sounds ominous. The other ominous feature is that this is from Plum and Posner's diagnosis of stupor and coma. So you know where this case is going. She's not febrile. Oops, sorry. She has a mild left hemiparesis and mild left inattention. So what happened here was this lady, it was thought that she had a stroke, like a right hemispheric stroke, which doesn't sound terribly unreasonable, but the CAT scan didn't show anything, so she was admitted to the stroke service. And when she was there, she spiked a fever. Not that typical, not unusual for stroke patients to spike a fever, but this lady already had a weird feature that she had a diffuse headache, which isn't that common for, which could be a right MCA stroke. And she had a fever, and she also was incoherent despite having a non-dominant hemisphere stroke, which is also a bit strange. So she was tapped that day, and she had some white cells. That's not normal. Five or more is abnormal. Protein is a little bit high. Glucose is high. And her opening pressure was normal. And let's say this is tube 4. You know, when you do an LP, you tap in tubes 1 and 4, so you should see the red cells clear. But in this patient, the red cells were still 19. She gets an MRI to look for a stroke, and it doesn't show a stroke. But on this flare sequence, which is good at looking at tissue injury, it shows this really high signal in the right temporal lobe and a little bit in the temporofrontal region. So what could this be? Good. So, but by the time this happened, she lapsed into a stupor. Her pupils became small and reactive, probably because both of her thalami were compressed. She had full roving eye movements, but wasn't really compos mentis. She developed some posturing, increased motor tone. She was starting a cyclovir, but it was too late. And end of story. So the moral is herpes encephalitis will kill you. So most patients almost always get fever at some point. It's usually before, but they almost always get fever at some point. Headache is almost, by rule, they should have headache. Headache and ischemic stroke happens in about a quarter of patients, but it's usually from posterior circulation strokes, usually from cerebellar strokes, even if it's not a hemorrhage. So focal deficits can happen. Seizures are, of course, really common. This lady had a seizure. Babial disturbance, of course. And the time course. So it's usually a days to week presentation, so acute to subacute. So do patients with HIV have more of a risk of getting herpes encephalitis? Right, so are they more at risk for it? So they're actually not. So immunosuppressed patients are not, the moral is they're not more at risk for it, but they're more likely to have an atypical presentation. So perhaps a more prolonged course, maybe a few less white cells in the CSF. So you have to have a much higher index of suspicion for it in patients who have a different presentation of it if they're immunosuppressed. And, you know, if you're untreated, almost three-quarters of patients die. And if you are, you know, almost a quarter of them die anyway. So this really has to be recognized. So the spinal fluid shows many white cells, but it also shows red cells because herpes causes hemorrhagic necrosis of the temporal lobe, and red cells will spill into the CSF. You know, the protein is usually a little high. PCR, of course, in brain biopsies, it's perfectly sensitive and specific, which doesn't really help us. It's often negative if you do it early. So you can get false negatives early on, which means you often have to repeat a tap, which is annoying, but good for your credentialing. But usually by a week, it's positive, even if they're on acyclovir. So the MRI shows patterns that are similar to this. The EEG shows this thing called PLEDS often, which is just a sign of acute destructive brain injury. Doesn't mean that the patient has herpes. You might have a patient in the ICU who has PLEDS. Sometimes it's a postictal phenomenon. Sometimes it's from an acute ischemic stroke that's large. Sometimes it's from hemorrhage into a brain tumor. But in this clinical situation, that would really heighten your suspicion. So, of course, you treat this with acyclovir. Of course, acyclovir is toxic, is nephrotoxic, so you have to be careful. So when do you stop it? I feel like this probably comes up often. So you have a patient who you're not sure. It's kind of a wishy-washy story. You're covering for them anyway. So if you have a high clinical suspicion and the PCR is negative for herpes, there's still somewhat of a chance that they have it. If the suspicion is quite low and the PCR is negative, then it's reasonable to stop it. And of course, that leaves a very huge gray area in between. So this is the last case. This is a really quick one. So 47-year-old hypertensive guy awoke with the most severe headache he's ever had. It's pounding, it's holocephalic, he's nauseous, and his family saw something was wrong, immediately called 911. His exam was normal. The CAT scan was done, the ER sent him out. So this is thunderclap headache. I mean, this is headache that's maximal at onset. So before you may have peeked at that slide, the thunderclap headache is often from what? Right, but it's often not. So what are other things that can cause it? So we've already talked about two of these cases. Two of these cases are able to present with thunderclap headache that we discussed earlier. So one was, sorry? So carotid dissection can present with thunderclap headache, and just you can also remember that by it's more likely to have headache than neck pain anyway. And what else? How about the postpartum lady? So cortical vein or venous sinus thrombosis can cause thunderclap headache. What else can cause thunderclap headache? So sure, that can. What else? Well, those are primary headache disorders, so they don't count. And they're usually not thunderclap in onset. What if I said a lady who was also pregnant developed severe headache and diabetes insipidus? From? Right, so pituitary apoplexy, absolutely. What else? There are some other oddball ones. So a CSF leak can, so not just high intracranial pressure, but low intracranial pressure. It doesn't have to be from an LP or an epidural injection. You can have spontaneous intracranial hypotension from a spontaneous CSF leak, which is usually in the spine. And it's often in patients who have an undiagnosed connective tissue disorder. So patients like that, they may look normal, they may have no history of Marfanoid, they may not look Marfanoid, they may not have any history of anything, but some people think that a lot of these patients have very hyperextendable digits, and it's a very soft clinical sign that they have some connective tissue disorder. So other ones that cause it, dissection we talked about, sentinel headache, meaning a brief transient rupture of an aneurysm causing leakage of blood before the big one happens. A colloid cyst in the third ventricle, which is a congenital cyst that will, when someone usually coughs or bears down, or Valsalva's, it compresses the third ventricle or the intraventricular foramen and causes acute severe hydrocephalus all of a sudden can cause this. So these are the main causes of it. So just because a patient comes in with thunderclap headache doesn't mean they have subarachnoid hemorrhage, but you better look. And how long should you wait to look? So this is what happens. I'll go back to this. So this is really important. So what often happens, I don't know if you guys see these cases, but as in neurology we do all the time. A patient comes to the ER, a week ago they had a severe headache, the worst onset. It kind of got better, but they came in a week later because their family members bugged them to come. The ER sees them, the patient looks totally fine, they do a CAT scan, it's normal, and they want to send them out. As neurology consults, we tell them the patient needs a tap. Why are you going to tap this patient? They look fine. So this is why. So when you do a tap for subarachnoid hemorrhage, what are you looking for? Right, so what is xanthochromia? Right, so it's the generated contents of red cells, usually from some bilirubin derivative, and it causes this yellow sediment in the CSF. So the only time where CAT scan is better than an LP is right away. So CAT scan will show subarachnoid hemorrhage almost all the time at the moment it starts. But as soon as you hit 12 hours after, xanthochromia is 100% sensitive. And xanthochromia remains 100% sensitive all the way to almost 3 weeks after it happens. So only half of patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage will have a CT finding a week later, but all of them should have xanthochromia in the CSF. So this is a really important slide. This is a neurology board question, and it could be a medicine board question too, where they say, they give you a patient like this, a week after a thunderclap headache, a patient comes in with a normal CAT scan, normal exam, should you still do an LP? And the answer should be yes. And that's all I have. Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.